He's that scared, huh?
He was petrified.
But what about you? Should we get you some protection? April hesitated.
I don't think Roberto... Well, maybe.
She shuddered. Okay, Dan said with a grimace. Get O'Connell from security on the phone for me. And I need to talk to Jerry Adair this morning. She nodded.
Anything else?
Dan hesitated a moment, then said, If Len's really gone, I'll need somebody to handle public relations around here.
I can call up a few headhunters.
Nope, can't afford them. Dan pointed a finger at her like a pistol and said, You can handle PR.
Me?
She looked shocked. You. If Len could do it, you can. You're a lot brighter than he is.
But I don't know anything about it,
April protested. Spreading his hands, Dan said, It's simple. When reporters ask you for information, you give them our canned answers. Len has a file full of pre-recorded statements. If you get a question that's not already covered, I'll help you write a response.
But
when we want to issue a news release, you've got Len's files, all his contacts, names, affiliations, phone numbers, email addresses, nothing to it. April looked dubious. You can do it, kid. PR is based on contacts, and Len built up a pretty good list.
There must be more to it than that, April said.
Nope, said Dan. I'll even give you a raise. A small one. She laughed.
Well, I'll try. But I don't know about this.
You'll be fine. Start a whole new career path for you. She shook her head warily, but stopped protesting.
All right,
she said slowly.
Is there anything else?
Dan shook his head. Not unless you can find me $1 billion someplace. And figure out how I can keep the wolves from the door.
You mean creditors?
I was thinking of Tricontinental in Yamagata, but yeah, we owe a lot of people a lot of money, don't we? Despite himself, Dan laughed.
Speaking of those particular wolves, April said, rising from her chair, you have calls waiting since Friday from Mr. Yamagata and Mr. Al-Bashir.
Terrific, said Dan. None the worse for the hours he'd spent at the Calhoun County Sheriff's Station, Roberto reported for work at the limo service's garage Monday morning. His only assignment was to pick up Asim Al-Bashir, arriving just before noon at Houston International Airport. The head dispatcher, a crusty old African-American, eyed Roberto suspiciously. Shaking his head, he said, You must be some kind of special. This Arab guy pays me to have you sitting around all morning just so he can have you drive him in from the airport. He won't take nobody else. Roberto's only reply was a grunt. What you doing with that Arab make him want you so bad? Roberto thought about lifting the shriveled old man off his feet and shaking him like a dried-out gourd, but the dispatcher had a sour courage that comes with age. He knew he was going to die soon anyway, so he wasn't afraid of much. Besides, the other drivers hanging around would jump in, and Roberto couldn't afford to get himself in trouble with the cops again while this B&E rap was hanging over his head in Calhoun County. With a glimmer of a teasing grin, the dispatcher said, I hear them Arabs a bunch of fags. This Arab romancing you, Roberto, my man? Roberto snatched the clipboard out of the old man's hand and snapped it in two, then wordlessly handed the broken pieces back to the stunned dispatcher and walked away. Washington, D.C. An unmarked sedan carried Jane from Ronald Reagan National Airport to her apartment building off DuPont Circle near Connecticut Avenue and Embassy Row. Being a United States senator has certain prerogatives. A member of that exclusive 100-member club can phone the director of Central Intelligence from her private plane on a Sunday evening and get the man to leave his dinner table to answer your call. A U.S. senator can phone the director of the FBI and ask her to cooperate as fully as possible with the CIA in an investigation of the Astro Corporation's space plane crash. But as she dressed for her working day on Capitol Hill in her tastefully luxurious apartment, Jane realized how quiet the place was, how empty and lonely. Her swirling thoughts kept coming back to Dan, his vigor, his passion, his drive. It was never quiet around Dan, never predictable or routine. Even the thing that had driven them apart, his insane zeal for creating this power satellite, was magnificent, bigger than life. And now it's brought us back together, at least for a moment. It can't be, Jane thought as she rode the empty elevator down to the garage where her car and driver waited for her, barely hearing the muted music whispering from the speaker in the ceiling.
Dan and I simply can't be together. I can't hurt Morgan like that. It would destroy him if I asked for a divorce. It would ruin his chances for the White House. It had all been planned so cleverly, so completely. Once Morgan had won the party's nomination, they would announce their marriage, even go through a formal ceremony. Tremendous publicity. And she would be at his side through the whole grueling campaign, every minute, every step of the way to the White House. I couldn't leave him once he's president, Jane thought. No one's divorced a president, not even after he's left office.
As her sedan took her to the Senate office building, Jane smiled bleakly to herself. But if ever a First Lady does divorce a president, it would be over Dan Randolph.
"Tell me what happened," Al-Bashir snapped, once Roberto pulled the limo away from the airport terminal.
Grudgingly, Roberto explained the fiasco with Kinski and April.
"Randolph's secretary?" Al-Bashir asked.
"She was there? She saw you?"
"Yeah,"
Roberto said, glancing at the Arab's round brown face in his rearview mirror.
"She's a peace man."
Al-Bashir glared at him.
"And you say the FBI was involved?"
"Some Chicano, big guy. He came in while they were questioning me. Talked to me in Spanish, big deal."
"The FBI," Al-Bashir mused. "This could be serious.
And what of your contact, this man Kinski?"
Roberto shrugged his heavy shoulders.
"Dunno. From the looks of him, though, he's running fast. Might be halfway to China by now."
How typical of a cowardly Jew, Al-Bashir thought. For several moments he remained silent, thinking swiftly while Roberto maneuvered the gleaming white limousine through the crowded freeway traffic. "I'll have to get rid of this oaf," he told himself. "I'll get the Tricontinental personnel people to find a job for him back in California. Tricontinental has a rehabilitation program. They'll be happy to add him to their list of good deeds. I can't afford to have him near me. He's too blunt an instrument for what needs to be done now. Besides," he thought, "I can infiltrate Astro Corporation myself now, and Dan Randolph will welcome me with open arms. Perhaps his secretary will too." The thought made Al-Bashir smile happily.
"Are you ready to fly the O2 bird?" Dan asked.
Jerry Adair turned toward him. Then he grinned.
"Is the Pope Catholic?"
They were standing side by side in Hangar B, where Niles Mohammed was sternly directing his crew as they carefully, tenderly, Dan realized, hoisted the space plane off the flatbed that it had been tied to and deposited it safely on the hangar's concrete floor. The air rang with Mohammed's deep-throated shouts and warnings. He even drowned out the electrical whine of the overhead crane.
"You're not rusty since the crash?"
"I've been in the simulator every day, Dan. I'm as ready as I can be."
"Good," Dan said, nodding. "Stay sharp."
"When do you think we can launch?"
Dan scratched his chin. "Couple weeks. Maybe sooner.
The legal eagles are working on clearances from 600 different double-damned government agencies."
"Will we land in Venezuela again?"
Dan hesitated.
"I don't know yet.
Maybe, maybe not."
Adair started to reply, but Mohammed strolled up to them and jabbed a thumb over his shoulder at the spaceplane sitting now on its three landing wheels. The flatbed truck ground its gears and started out of the hangar with a roar and a stench of diesel fumes.
"Okay, flyboy. You said you wanted to check out the cockpit," Mohammed said.
Adair nodded once and sprinted toward the spaceplane like a kid heading for his Christmas presents. Dan saw that the crew had rolled up a set of metal stairs.
"Don't know why he's got to go sit in the cockpit," Mohammed groused. "The bird ain't going nowhere."
Dan grinned at him. "He's a pilot, Niles. He'd sleep in there if you'd let him. He'd take his meals in there." Mohammed shook his head.
"Nobody's gonna mess up my cockpit with crumbs and stuff."
Dan laughed, thinking, "Maybe I ought to put Niles in charge of security." April was startled when she returned to her apartment. As she opened the front door, she heard country and western music twanging from her radio. She knew she hadn't left the radio on when she'd left in the morning, and even if she had, she'd never leave it tuned to that wailing of losers. Cautiously, she edged the door halfway open,
ready to run back to her car if Roberto or some stranger were in her apartment.